57. In the sterile, rudely furnished cell, it seemed to Nora that she sat next to Tappan for an age. In silence, her mind in turmoil, trying to make sense of everything, figure out what to do. In the wide corridors beyond their windowless door, it had been almost as silent, except for the rare tramping of feet. "Lucas," she said at last. Her own voice sounded strange after not speaking for so long. Tappan, on the bunk beside her, didn't answer. "Lucas," she said again, "I've been thinking." Then, turning to look at him, she stopped. The entrepreneur seemed frozen, staring ahead but not seeing, a faraway look in his eyes. She reared back, cocked one fist, then hit him in the arm. "Whoa!" he cried as he sat up, massaging his arm. "What was that for?" "You were lost in thought. I needed to get your attention." He glowered at her, one half of his visage crusted with dried blood, looking as two-faced as Janus.
"Well, you didn't need to give me a hematoma in the process."
"You can fire me later. Tell me, what have you been thinking about?" He paused, still massaging his arm.
"That this is my fault. I've been so blinded by our progress and by my success throwing money at a problem until it goes away that I didn't see the warning signs."
"What warning signs?"
"The early pushback that suddenly went away. The disappearance of Baton."
Tappan shook his head.
"The conspiracy theorists were right all along. There was a cover-up, even worse than anyone imagined. I should have expected a reaction like this."
"Well, since we're in the belly of the beast, we'd better figure out what we're going to do."
"Just what do you have in mind?"
"The Colonel made us an offer. We need to consider it." She then leaned over for a brief, affirming hug, then whispered ever so quietly in his ear. "They're listening and watching, of course." Tappan nodded. He said,
"I'm pretty sure he's going to kill us, no matter what we do."
"Maybe not."
"Explain."
"This organization operates way under the radar," Nora said. She wondered if Tappan was going to understand and follow her lead in pretending to cooperate, to buy them some time.
"Yeah, they probably killed Baton under the radar, too."
"The point is, they don't go around announcing their presence. They don't act hastily. We've been digging for, what, 2 weeks now? They must have been monitoring us the whole time. They only acted when their backs were against the wall, and we were about to make a shattering discovery. They're cautious, methodical." Tappan shook his head vigorously. Nora persisted. "They're not going to suddenly break profile and wipe us all out."
"And you know this how?"
Tappan waved a hand vaguely toward the cell door.
"You've seen their reach. You've seen their resources. Sure, and once we've told Rush what we know, he'll kill us."
"I don't think so. In some ways, they're as much in the dark as we are. About us, I mean, and how wide the circle of knowledge has grown. Remember that practically the Colonel's first question to you was, who else knows about this? But he also said we could be valuable to his organization."
"If he thinks I'm going to jump through hoops for him after what he's done, he can go fuck himself."
Nora paused. She still wasn't sure where Tappan was coming from. But a further whispered confab would be disastrous. Without doubt, they were being watched as well as listened to. "We're not going to jump through hoops, but we have to consider his offer."
"Why?"
"Why?" Nora laughed. "Because it just might save the lives of others. That's why. Think of it from Russia's point of view. You own Icarus Space Systems and half the wind turbines in North America. You've got plenty of resources. In certain areas, I'll bet more than they've got. That gives you leverage. And it gives Rush a huge incentive to recruit you."
"I don't sense any shortage of resources around here." Hasn't it struck you how huge this place is, yet how empty it seems?
Yeah, all their 00 agents are out, shooting everybody who knows or might know anything.
Nora shook this away.
No, they're clearly not the kind to go off half-cocked. Rush spoke of an organization at war, but where's his army?
I'm betting they had a much easier time getting recruits in 1947 than they do now. Think about it. Countless soldiers recently demobilized from World War II. The Cold War and its attendant paranoia ramping up. Patriotism at an all-time high. Do you think it's surprising almost all the sci-fi movies from that period featured evil, destructive aliens? She paused. Things are different today. Our fears have changed. But they haven't.
So do you buy what they say?
Tappan asked.
About these aliens preparing to attack the planet?
Nora wished she could be sure Tappan understood she was playing for time, a charade she was putting on for their eavesdroppers.
He mentioned documentary evidence, and he seemed willing to show it to us. He's sincere. We need to see this evidence.
Okay, Tappan replied after a silence. What you say makes sense. We owe it to ourselves to see just why he's so convinced the Earth is in danger. We owe it to science.
Suddenly, he took Nora's face in both hands.
And now that I think about it, cooperation sure beats the alternative.
He kissed her.
You're one hell of a woman, you know that? Just please don't ever hit me like that again.
I promise, she said. Footsteps in the hall, and with a turning of a lock, the two quickly separated. The door opened onto the same two heavily armed guards that had brought them to the cell. Silently, they gestured for Nora and Tappan to stand and step out into the cell block. Then, one in front and the other bringing up the rear, as before, they led Nora and Tappan back in the direction from which they'd come. But this time, they walked past the heavy door and farther along the wide corridor to a set of doors larger than all the others. The label 019 was stenciled on them in large white digits. This time, the soldiers did not open the doors themselves. One covered the two prisoners, while the other entered a number on a keypad. The huge doors whispered back to reveal an echoing hangar. Prodded by the soldiers, Nora stepped forward, began to look around, and then caught her breath in numb disbelief.
58. The fence loomed out of the darkness, concertina wire at the top gleaming faintly against the stars. They moved up to it silently, pausing to look around. Corey scanning for signs of security cameras. She could see none. The fence itself looked decrepit and rusty, but on closer inspection, the dilapidation proved superficial. Battered no trespassing and danger high voltage signs were attached to it at regular intervals. Beyond, she could see the shadowy outlines of ruined buildings.
Check out those two heavy wires, Watts murmured. They're attached with insulators. This baby's electrified.
Skip nodded.
I wouldn't be surprised if it was alarmed as well.
How are we going to get in? Corey asked.
Good question, Watts replied.
They stood for a while, just staring at the fence. Even if they could get over it without being electrocuted, which seemed impossible, Skip was right. It would surely set off an alarm. Once on the other side, they'd be hunted down quickly.
Maybe we could short-circuit it, said Skip. That would set off the alarms even faster, said Watts.
While they were talking, Corey heard the low hoot of an owl, and then a sudden crackling and flash of light appeared about 20 feet up the fence. They ducked down and listened.
What the hell was that? Skip whispered. Did an owl just get zapped?
Watts gestured for them to move along the fence toward the flash. He knelt to inspect the ground, looking for a bird, but shook his head, unable to see what might have caused it.
Let's walk a little farther, he whispered, just in case there's a weak spot in the fence. They moved along in single file, scanning the perimeter, but nowhere did it look possible to breach. Watts stopped periodically to examine the ground.
"What are we going to do?" Skip finally asked.
Watts shook his head.
"I'm stumped."
Another crackle split the night, with a flash of light 100 yards farther up.
"You think it's a pack of animals?" Corey asked.
"Maybe a short, if we're lucky," said Skip. "Let's go look."
They continued northward. Here, the fence ran through some steep outcroppings of rock, forcing them to walk in single file. Watts crouched again.
"I'll be damned."
A stick lay on the ground, still smoking.
"How did this happen?"
Skip bent over to look as well. Corey, bringing up the rear, suddenly felt herself seized from behind. One arm wrapped around her throat while hard, cold steel was pressed against her temple, forcing her back behind the cover of an outcropping. Watts jumped up and pulled his weapon, but didn't fire.
"You're right to think it through," came a voice. "Now drop it."
It was Lime. He must have taken the dead soldier's gun from the wreck of the chopper. Watts didn't move.
"You have no shot, and you know it. Stretch out your hand and drop the weapon. Now, or she dies."
Watts complied as Corey felt Lime take back his weapon from her holster. Pushing her forward, he emerged from behind the rock. Lime kicked Watts's weapon away.
"We share a common problem," he said. "How to get through that fence. Right, Corey?"
He gave her a little shake.
"Fuck you."
"You were turning into a good agent. Unfortunately, in this particular situation, too good. I realized that when we watched you search Morwood's house and saw what even we had missed. I truly regret losing you. I can't say the same, however, about your friends."
Lime gave a dry laugh.
"Sheriff, they told me you were some sort of hotshot gunman, and you did outdraw me back there. That psychological trick of mine never failed me before. But it's a pretty sad commentary, how you let me get the drop on you. And given the way Mr. Kelly here crashed the chopper, I presume he suffers from suicidal mania."
He suddenly shoved Corey to the ground. Keeping the gun trained on them, he circled around to Skip.
"Move just once, and I'll indulge that death wish of yours."
He took Skip's forearm and jerked it behind his back, forcing Skip to bend down. He shoved the gun in Skip's ear and said to Corey,
"You can get up. Keep your hands in sight."
Corey rose cautiously, showing her hands. Lime went on.
"I've got a solution to our problem. A way for us to get in and alert the base in a hurry to your presence. Elwyn Kelly here is going to help. Right, Elwyn?"
Lime propelled him toward the fence, keeping the gun pointed at his ear.
"That fence carries 6,000 volts at 11 amps. More than an electric chair. I saw a deer run into it once. That was some show."
He pushed Skip closer. Corey could hear the wires humming and smell the electricity in the air, and she realized with sudden horror just what Lime planned to do. She braced herself as Lime spun Skip forward toward the fence, using himself as a pivot. But Skip twisted around just as Lime shoved him, and at that moment, Corey lunged forward, slamming into Lime like a linebacker. The blow propelled the already off-balance Lime past Skip, turning his own momentum against him as Skip wrenched free of his grasp. The gun went off as it flew from his hands, while Lime windmilled, twisting backward and grunting in an effort to recover his balance. He succeeded only in striking the fence full-on with the back of his body, from head to thigh. There was a great flash boom of sound and light. Lime screamed briefly, once, as coruscating sparks rose like the embers of a disturbed campfire into the night sky. His skin began to fry with the sound of raw meat being seared in hot grease.
first clothes, then hair bursting into flame.
The wires popped and vaporized around him, whipping in sync with his writhing form.
His eyes filled with crimson, swelled grotesquely, then popped, one after the other. And then all was quiet, save for the crackle of smoldering weeds from a little ground fire triggered by the shower of sparks. The dead wires dangled, spitting ineffectually.
Lime smoking remains were stuck against the fence, now sagging inward. The concertina wire partially melted and falling away to one side.
For a moment, no one moved. Corey stared in horrified fascination.
"Hey," Skip said, breaking the spell. "The circuit's broken. We can get in. Quick!"
He scampered up and over the dead body, which, effectively glued to the sagging fence, bounced up and down like a spring under the impact of his feet. Skip eased aside the melted concertina wire, then ducked under and passed.
"Hurry up! They'll be here any minute!"
Corey snatched up her gun from where it had fallen and then rushed across the improvised bridge, which had begun to smell like an overdone porterhouse, and under the fence. Watts followed suit.
"Into the ruins," said Skip.
They sprinted into some sort of dormitory, with skeletons of cots arrayed in ghostly rows. They took cover in a small annex in the back, with a broken window facing northward.
"Jesus," said Watts. "Did you two rehearse that martial arts move, or what?"
"Dumb luck," said Corey. She turned to Skip.
"Why did he call you Elwyn?"
"Forget it."
They waited, recovering their breath. Seconds afterward, Corey heard a low vibration. Peering through the window, they saw a rectangular shape rise from the side of, in fact, apparently out of, a nondescript hill.
"You see that?" Skip whispered. "It's a door, embedded in the side of the hill."
Lights appeared in the portal, and then a jeep, then a second, emerged at high speed, headlights lancing through the darkness. They raced over the desert, heading toward the fence, where Lime's body was hung up amid the weedy ground fire. The jeep screeched to a halt while Corey and the rest kept in the shadows of the ruined building.
"Oh, Jesus," said a man in uniform as he leapt out, voice clear in the cool night air.
The others all piled out, weapons in hand.
"The fucker tried to climb over," another voice said. "What the hell was he doing out here? Maybe from that crashed chopper."
They clustered around the scorched corpse.
"See if he's got ID."
Corey watched as they busied themselves with the body, prying it off the fence and shining the light in the face.
"Good God," the commander cried. "It's Lime. What the hell was he doing, trying to climb that fence? Idiot. Stick a fork in him. He's done."
There was a burst of talk and radio chatter as they discussed what to do. Within minutes, they loaded the body into the back of one jeep, restrung the live wires, fixed the fence, and drove back to the portal in the hill, which then closed slowly and silently behind them. All went quiet.
"It looks like we're in the clear," said Corey. "What now?"
It was Skip who answered.
"We go get my sister."
59. The fact that neither she nor Watts moved in response to Skip's statement drove home to Corey that they had no plan. They were three people up against some kind of military base.
"We can't defeat them all. Can we agree on that?" Watts said. "I'm not leaving without Nora," said Skip defiantly.
"Look," said Corey, "for God's sake, think through the choices we're facing here. We can't stay where we are. We can't walk out to get help, and we've got neither truck nor radio equipment. Ergo, Skip's right. We go in."
"And do what?"
Watts asked.
"Evaluate our options. We don't know what's down there, how many people, how well guarded. But down there is where we've got to go. Then we figure out a plan."
"In other words, out of the frying pan and into the fire," said Watts. Maybe that guy Lime was right about you, Skip. It's suicide.
It's the only option, Corey said firmly. We're just wasting time talking about it. Let's check our ammo.
She took out Lime's Glock 19 and ejected the magazine.
15.
She racked the slide.
I've got 4, said Watts. It's obvious that whatever's here is underground, Skip said. There have to be air vents or openings somewhere.
They cautiously moved out of the barracks into the landscape. Corey hand-signaled for them to spread out. There was no moon, but the desert air was so clear that starlight gave them just enough illumination to see. Beyond the barracks were more ruins and a parade ground of concrete riddled with cracks, resembling a field of rubble. They kept to the darkest areas. It felt so desolate it was hard to believe there was anyone within miles, let alone a secret base under their feet.
Over here, Skip suddenly said in a low voice.
Corey and Watts came over to find Skip standing next to an old corrugated shaft sunk into the ground, covered with a corroded grill of wire mesh.
Smell that air coming up.
Corey leaned over. A clean, cool draft rose, redolent of warm electronics and, oddly, French fries.
Here's our way in, Skip said. Are you kidding?
Watts said, staring into the black maw.
You have no idea where it goes. We don't even have a light. We might get stuck. I can shinny down, said Skip. See where it goes.
That requires chimney climbing experience. Corey paused. You don't know the technique. I do.
Oh, no, said Watts. No one's going down there. We'll find another way in.
We don't have time, said Corey. I'm going.
No, Skip said. I will. It's my sister.
For fuck's sake, the person with climbing experience should go first.
Without waiting for any more argument, Corey yanked off the loose grill, then swung herself over the opening. She glanced around. Against the starlight, Watts's ruined resistol looked utterly ridiculous. His silhouette was a cross between the little tramp and Chico Marx.
Lose the hat, she said. If we get killed down there, you'll want to leave a good-looking corpse.
This hat isn't going anywhere until I can get another.
Suit yourself.
Then she lowered herself down, using the corrugated side of the shaft for footholds, back braced against the opposite side. Below her it was black as night, and there was absolutely no indication of how far the tube descended. She inched her way down by a classic counterforce technique and was soon swallowed in darkness. Looking up, she could see a single star, which gave her comfort. But even that vanished as she went deeper, and despite herself, she felt a primitive terror begin to well up from within. It was so black that swirls and shapes began to cross her field of vision. Was Watts right? And the shaft was getting narrower? It felt like it, but she told herself that had to be her rising panic. She stopped. How deep was she? It seemed like she'd been lowering herself forever. Her muscles were trembling with the effort, her heart pounding. She wanted to call up, to hear a reassuring voice, but she didn't dare chance alerting whoever was below. If anybody was below. God, what if the shaft dead-ended and she didn't have the strength to ascend? What if it ended in a furnace? She tried to shut down her panic and focus on one movement at a time. As she worked her way deeper, she became aware of a faint glow from below. Her sudden relief was quickly replaced by the uncertainty of what she might find and who might be there. She felt the tunnel branch into a horizontal T, and then her feet touched the bottom of the shaft. With vast relief, she gingerly stood up to full height and recovered her breath. The dim light was coming in from the tunnel to her left. She knelt and crawled along it. After a short distance, it ended in a flimsy louvered vent, set into a ceiling and overlooking a large, unlit room packed with blinking servers, the only sound the hum of air conditioning.
At the far door of the room was a man with a rifle, evidently standing guard, eating French fries, paying no attention to anything. Corey backed up, then climbed a few feet up the shaft.
"Hey,"
she said in a low tone.
"Hey!"
Watts's distant voice floated down softly.
"Hey yourself!"
"It's a way in. Come down. Brace yourself on opposite sides, feet on one, back and hands against the other. Keep up the tension, or you'll fall. And for God's sake, be quiet."
"Copy. We're coming down."
60. The hangar was large, even by the standards of the sprawling underground complex. Along the reinforced walls, Nora saw a fantastic array of equipment. Video cameras, computers, monitoring and recording devices, sensors, an array of large diaphragm Neumann microphones. The ceiling was busy with cabling, studio spotlights, and dozens of small stainless steel devices that looked like industrial sprinklers. But it was what lay directly before her, in the center of the huge space, that instantly caught and utterly dominated her attention. A craft of some kind rested in a cradle made of a dull black material. The moment she set eyes on it, she knew that the thing was not of this earth. Her lingering skepticism was instantly consumed in the face of this transfixing, irrefutable proof. The thing's surface shimmered like liquid mercury, seemingly in motion beneath the lights, as if so many coats of lacquer had been applied that it appeared more like the surface of a limpid pool than a hull. She could not say exactly what color it was. It seemed somehow like all colors to her, or perhaps even a color that was entirely new. It was not especially large, roughly the size of the Apollo lunar module, but it couldn't have looked more different from that ungainly craft. This had a sleek, flowing, organic shape, like a wingless bird hovering on a thermal. There were no sharp edges, no marks or insignia, no windows or portholes or projecting equipment, except toward the nose, where an oval rent of some kind was visible, around which the metallic flow turned into something closer to a small whirlpool. She was reminded of Jupiter's great red spot, roiling uneasily in a sickly green color. Placed around, at some remove, were several tall monolithic barriers or blast walls of what again appeared to be graphite, arranged in an offset pattern like the sound baffles in a music studio. The spacecraft was surrounded by rings painted on the floor. The outermost yellow, the next one orange, and then the final inner one red. Various warnings and numbers were stenciled between the nested circles. Spacecraft. The word had come to her mind instinctively, unconsciously. But in just the last 60 seconds, all lingering uncertainty had drained from her. It was impossible for human science to build, even simulate, a hull like that. Despite the gravity of their situation, the armed soldiers, the hostile underground base, she felt an unexpected relief as she realized she could stop fighting now. She could let all her cynicism, doubt, and scientific skepticism simply melt away like an unwanted weight, to be replaced by wonder. Without thinking, overcome with awe, she took a step toward it.
"I wouldn't do that," Rush said.
Nora stopped.
"It looks quiescent, I know, but the appearance is deceptive. During our initial reconnaissance in 1947, that thing killed 24 soldiers. In the subsequent salvage operation, it took the lives of almost half again as many."
Nora listened, unable to take her eyes from the otherworldly ship.
"We only managed to get it back here to Pershing, as it turned out, the closest available site, by encasing it in graphite shields. As far as we've been able to determine, the neutron-reflecting properties of graphite offered protection. Partial protection, that is, and only temporary. It appears to have adapted its weaponry to compensate. As a result, we couldn't risk trying to move it elsewhere. However, Pershing ended up suiting our needs exactly. An abandoned base with tunnels that could easily be expanded, full of hazardous waste and unexploded ordnance, strictly off-limits.
But Nora was still staring, and then she began to wonder if her eyes were playing tricks on her. When she'd first entered the hangar, she'd been sure the craft had a long, graceful neck, like a goose or swan in flight. But she blinked. What she thought had been a neck now looked more like a truncated collar. And yet no lighting or other optical effect of the room had been altered.
"Did it just change shape?" she asked.
Rush sighed, perhaps in exasperation.
"We can discuss such details later. It would be easiest if you just watch this. Follow me, please."
He led the way across the echoing hangar toward a small viewing area set near an equipment-festooned wall behind a plexiglass enclosure. As they walked, Nora saw the small black chest containing their recent discovery placed on a graphite table, with barriers being put up around it. Rush motioned for them to sit down before the viewing area's large monitor, then took a seat beside them and reached for a remote control.
"I'm going to show you a very brief overview of the last 75 years," he said. "It won't take long, but it's important to demonstrate the nature of the device."
Now the monitor came to life, showing what appeared to be an old black and white film strip, full of scratches, warping, and jitter. Several anachronistic warning messages from the U.S. Army, the Department of Defense, and other entities appeared, asserting how sensitive the video was and offering a variety of maledictions against anyone who tried to duplicate it or otherwise make its contents known. Then the word Alpha was displayed on a title card, and the scene shifted to a desert setting, a remote location with a high, cloudless sky of gray against a gray sun. Almost immediately, Nora recognized it as their forward dig site. The surrounding topography had changed, but it was nevertheless unmistakable. She could see a cordon of soldiers forming a secure perimeter, weapons at the ready. Various 1940s-era military jeeps, troop trucks, and ambulances were parked nearby. At the center was the same craft that now sat in this vault. It appeared to be half dug out of the earth, or perhaps that was where it had come to land, and the dirt and sand around it were dotted with large, dark stains.
"This was taken the day after we located the device," Rush said.
Now on screen, two soldiers approached cautiously. The one in front held what looked like a minesweeper. The one slightly behind him had a carbine at the ready. They stepped closer, then still closer. Except for the carbine, their movements were not obviously threatening. Suddenly, there was a bright light, so bright that the film lost all contrast, its emulsion fully exposed. Over several seconds, the light receded. Once the landscape came into view again, the soldiers were gone and there were two additional dark stains in the sand beside the craft.
"That is how we were greeted," Rush said, "again and again."
"It probably thought they were armed," Tappan said, "and it wasn't wrong."
Rush laughed mirthlessly.
"It was approached, has been approached, in every way you could imagine. The best minds have been tasked with solving how to communicate with it, to demonstrate our friendly intentions. We've been met only with sudden violence and death."
He nodded toward the craft.
"Like I said, it looks quiescent. But finding an environment to keep it that way has been the work of decades, at the price of countless millions of dollars and many, many lives."
Now the film strip changed. It was still black and white, but the orientation was different, and the position was farther away. Nora watched as two tanks approached the craft, which had now been removed from the earth and lay on its side, not unlike its current position here in the vault. Both tanks stopped some distance away, then fired a number of shells from their turrets directly at the craft, without discernible effect.
Friendly intentions, huh? Tappan said. This was 1947, Rush replied, as if that explained everything. After a moment, one of the tanks drew closer. Again, there was a flash that blew out the film's exposure.
Anyway, Rush added as the flash died away, humans don't seem to have the technology to damage it, or even look inside it. It has repulsed every effort. We've never been able to extract or derive any meaningful technology from it.
The film moved forward in time. The aspect ratio changed, and color was introduced. It had the faintly blurred look of videotape. The craft was in the hangar where they now sat, except the space was far barer, with less equipment and fewer monitoring devices. Scientists in white coats and support staff in street clothes, from which she guessed the era to be the 1970s, worked busily around the craft at a safe distance. As she watched, a rack with a DEC minicomputer cabled to measuring equipment was slowly lowered toward the object via overhead wires. The video now sported audio, and she could hear, in various languages, messages being piped toward the craft, telling it that no harm would come to it, and that communication was the only goal. The minicomputer rack kept inching down, like a huge spider descending on its spinnerets. Moments later, the flashes began again. This time, filters had apparently been placed on the camera lens, and it was possible to differentiate three separate bursts of light. But beyond that, nothing more.
We tried every possible means of signaling to it, Rush said. Every means of studying it, reverse engineering it, even merely examining its technology. But every attempt, no matter how novel or advanced, ended in failure. Approaching too close inevitably triggers its weaponry.
It's probably just a self-defense mechanism, Tappan said.
Rush glanced at him.
Indeed, if this device is so advanced, don't you think it would have learned by now, adapted, the same way its weapons have adapted to graphite? No, it's implacably hostile. It kills or destroys anything that gets close. We believe that if it weren't damaged, you saw that odd dent in its side, it would be far more lethal. The entire planet might be at risk.
Once again, the film jumped forward in time. Now the hangar looked much closer to its current configuration. Nora watched for perhaps 5 minutes as a series of mobile robots approached the craft using a variety of tactics, followed by several small drones. Each met the usual end.
We tried everything, even inert compounds, Rush said. We understand from remote measurements how the weapon works, more or less, but we've made no progress at all on how to stop it.
Those flashes, Tappan said. Why can't you film them in slow motion and see what's going on?
We have. It appears the weapon analyzes the atomic makeup of what it perceives to be a hostile object, then inverts its atomic structure.
Inverts? How?
Again, Rush sighed in frustration.
Performs a logical OR on its natural state. That is, a logical disjunction applied to matter. The technology is far beyond our understanding.
The monitor went blank as the film ended, and he turned to Nora and Tappan.
These questions you're asking, they're pitifully ignorant. We'd moved beyond them before you were even born. Maybe soon you'll have the time to examine the thousands of pages of research papers, test results, theories, lab notes, and terabytes of data we've accumulated. Now, under the circumstances, I've been remarkably patient, especially given all the trouble you've caused us. The point you must understand is a simple one. All our painstaking lines of analysis have led to one conclusion. That craft is a weapon from an alien civilization intent on destruction or conquest. At the very least, it's a recon vessel searching for targets.
It's so dangerous that this base has an integrated self-destruct system, so the probe, should it suddenly become mobile again, can't unleash itself upon humanity. Again, he glanced from one to the other. Look at you. You're so fascinated by the device, you've been blinded to the bigger picture. Who knows when the next one might come along, undamaged and perhaps even more advanced. That's why Atropos has made it our lifetime duty to thwart attempts to contact aliens or attract their attention. We can't do anything about the damned electromagnetic radiation streaming from Earth, at least not now. But there are other steps we have taken.
The Colonel rose from his chair.
You've seen the evidence. I've shown you the history. I've kept nothing back. We can use people like you. Your expertise, Dr. Kelly, and your money and reach, Mr. Tappan. We need you. We know of your relationship, of course, and there's no reason that can't continue. Now, will you take up the cause?
61. By virtue of her position, Corey had to be the first out of the vent. There was no way to pass one another in the narrow space. That meant she had to be the one to take out the guard. Watts held out a knife.
Cut his throat, he whispered. Otherwise, he'll make noise.
Corey felt sick. She'd never killed anyone, certainly not in a way as cold-blooded as this. Watts sensed her hesitation.
It takes a lot more force than you might think. If you don't cut all the way through the cartilage on the first swipe, he could still manage to scream.
The guard in the doorway had finished his fries and was now just standing, slouched, marking time. He was surprisingly old, close to 50, a sad sack of a soldier.
I can't do this, Corey whispered.
We've got no choice. For all we know, they blew up everyone back at the camp.
Corey swallowed.
I still can't.
After a moment, Watts sighed quietly.
I respect that.
Then she heard him tap loudly on the side of the pipe. She waited, holding her breath. The soldier turned and glanced into the room, looking first one way and then the other. He took a step inside, hit a switch to turn on the lights. He peered around, then made a perfunctory tour. Seeing nothing amiss, he returned to the door and turned off the lights. Right behind her, Watts tapped again on the duct, twice, even more loudly. She could feel his breath on her neck. The guard's head jerked upward. Now he was on high alert. He turned the lights back on and came slowly over to their area, looking around. He didn't look up. He walked past and stopped. And then he looked up. Corey didn't dare move. Her view was between narrow louvers. From below, the guard's eyes were fixated on the vent. He moved closer, squinting, and removed his rifle. The expression on his face was more suspicious than certain. He took another step, staring upward, scanning the ceiling beyond the vent. She felt Watts touch her shoulder.
Plug your ears.
She did.
Up here, said Watts loudly.
The soldier's face registered surprise and fear as he swung around, his eyes fixing again on the vent. He raised his weapon. Watts fired through the louver. The soldier's head snapped back in a spray of blood and matter, the weapon clattering to the floor.
Go, said Watts.
Corey kicked open the vent and dropped down, followed immediately by Watts and Skip. The soldier lay sprawled grotesquely in a spreading pool of blood.
We'll fight them from the cover of these computers, said Watts. Nice knowing you.
They ran into the rows of servers and waited for the response. Seconds ticked by, then minutes.
I'll be damned, said Watts. I don't think anyone's coming.
They let another minute pass.
I'll bet they're all busy with shit elsewhere, said Skip. Looking for us outside, maybe.
They cautiously approached the door where the dead soldier lay. Skip hesitated a second, then reached down and took his sidearm, wiping it on the man's uniform. The gun was, she noted, identical to hers and Lime's,
standard issue for military and law enforcement. Beyond the door, a broad cinder block hall, painted yellow and green, ran for 100 feet. There were no signs of security cameras or guards, and no doors. Watt stepped out and led the way, walking silently, communicating with hand signals, while Corey covered the rear. At the first corner, Watts halted and peered around, then waved them forward. The next corridor was lined with lettered doors. The corridors branched, then branched again. More lettered doors, more unknown rooms, but no people. The place was obviously huge, and although everything looked clean and well-kept, it was oddly deserted. Watts stopped and touched his ear. Listening, Corey could hear sounds at the very edge of audibility. There were people ahead.
"Incredible, there's no CCTV system in here," Skip whispered.
"They probably think it's so secure they don't need it," Watts replied.
The corridor ended at a T-junction, and before them stood a set of steel doors, slightly ajar, with porthole windows. Cautiously, Corey peered through the seam between the doors. It revealed a large room that had the look of a lobby in a hospital ward. Brightly lit and sterile, with rooms on both sides, one apparently a kitchen. Now Corey saw the first people since the guard, a woman in uniform beside a man carrying a tray of food. They crossed the lobby and approached a room. As the door opened and shut, Corey briefly heard a woman's voice, loud and angry.
"God, that's Cecilia," said Skip.
He glanced at Corey.
"Cecilia Toth, the engineer."
"She sounds hurt," said Corey.
The two figures came back out, closed the door, and then disappeared around a bend in the hall. All went quiet.
"She'll have information," said Skip. "Information we need."
They passed through the doors, moving quietly, then opened the door to the room and ducked in. Cecilia was shackled to the bed frame, her leg bandaged. Watts motioned for silence as she rose, struggling against the shackles.
"Where's Nora?"
Skip asked her in an urgent voice.
"What is this place?"
"They took Nora away," Toth said, "along with Tappan, shortly after we left the motor pool."
"Where?"
"I don't know. Right, past those double doors you just came in."
"What happened to you?" Corey asked.
"The bastards killed Emilio. I got hit with a stray round."
"We're going to get you out," said Corey. "Can you walk?"
"I don't think so. They haven't given me any painkillers. Moving hurts like hell."
"Where's this motor pool?"
"Left, down the corridor beyond the doors. There's a helicopter bay next to it. Just keep going straight."
"Where is everyone?"
"I don't know."
"We're going to come back for you," Corey said again. "Just stay cool." As they moved back to the lobby and then turned left beyond the doors, Corey quickly sensed they were entering a more populated section of the facility. At several moments, they had to duck into storerooms or abandoned labs to avoid soldiers. Another time, an electric vehicle, an armored, open-topped Jeep, could be seen passing down the hallway.
"Let's commandeer one of those," said Skip. "Shoot the fuckers right out of the saddle and take it."
"You may not have noticed," said Corey, "but they've got bulletproof glass and panels. You're not going to shoot out anyone driving one of those."
"Then we steal one from this motor pool."
They followed faint rubber tire tracks now visible on the cement floor, confident these would lead to the motor pool. As they crept farther down the endless hallway, they heard voices and activity. Ahead, they could see the corridor open into a large space, a ramp leading up one side to a tall set of steel doors. As Corey watched, they opened, folding fan-like back on themselves with a quiet rumble. They ducked through the last door of the corridor into what appeared to be a mothballed medical lab, but not before Corey got a better glimpse of the cavernous room that lay ahead. There were a variety of parked vehicles, patrolled by guards who looked a lot more alert than the sad sack in the server room. There was also, as Toth had mentioned, a helicopter, sitting silent and dark on a steel pad. The ramp on the far side, she guessed,
must lead up to the portal they'd seen hidden in the side of a small hill. Clearly, it was a way out.
I see only two guards, said Watts. We can take those bastards.
There could be more on the far side, Corey said. That's a big space.
Shit,
Watts muttered. Skip hesitated.
You're a much better shot than me, he told Watts. Maybe we should exchange weapons. This one's got a full 16 rounds.
Watts frowned.
This peacemaker was my granddad's.
He took the revolver out and hefted it.
It kicks like a mule, and it's hard to aim. Look, I can't shoot worth shit anyway. If it makes a big noise, that's all that matters. You've got 5 times the number of rounds in that Glock, and you're probably going to need them all.
Watts handed Skip the peacemaker and accepted the Glock, which he tucked in his belt.
I wish to hell we could somehow shift the odds in our favor.
Corey looked around. The medical lab they were in had obviously not been used in some time. Shelves of bottles and containers lined the walls. An old black soapstone table ran down the far wall, flanked by fume hoods. It was like the rest of the base, clean and orderly, but fallen into disuse. In the dim light, she crept over and began examining the bottles, squinting at the labels.
What are you looking for?
Watts asked.
This.
She plucked a large bottle off a shelf. What you find in every lab in the country. Ethanol. Skip suddenly grinned.
That's what I'm talking about. Who's got a lighter?
Watts removed one from his pocket and tossed it to Skip. They quickly collected a half dozen smaller bottles with narrow mouths, emptied their contents, and refilled them with ethanol, stuffing wadded gauze into the necks. As they worked quickly and silently, the keen smell of pure grain alcohol filled the room.
Skip, you'll be the Molotov cocktail guy, said Corey. Create maximum surprise and confusion. Hit the chopper if possible, so it can't follow us once we escape. Shoot off that big old hog leg now, and then put the fear of God into everyone. The sheriff and I go in blazing on either flank.
Go in blazing, repeated Watts. Still suicide, only maybe not quite as certain.
62. Rush stepped out of the viewing alcove.
Come with me.
Nora and Tappan rose to follow. He halted some distance from the craft, turned, and folded one arm over the other, clearly waiting for an answer. There was a brief, awkward silence.
Colonel, Tappan said. You're a convincing recruiter. No doubt you've performed that little dog and pony show before. I could probably use you in the HR department of Icarus Space Systems. But how do I...
And at this, he stepped closer to Nora.
How do we know you aren't just milking us for information, to be shot and discarded when you've wrung us dry?
Nora was glad Tappan had moved close to her. The fact that Atropos knew of their relationship, not surprising in retrospect, meant that to ensure the cooperation of one, Atropos would have to spare both. Even so, she wondered if Tappan was laying it on a little thick. It crossed her mind that she still didn't know what he was really thinking, if he was being sincere, or if he was going along with her scheme. Truth was, she didn't know him all that well, despite their connection.
Colonel Rush, Nora said, you tell us you've kept nothing back.
Well, I'll be equally blunt. Did you blow up the camp?
No, we did not. We merely destroyed all your data and equipment. The people are fine.
You've obviously killed other innocents, like Emilio Vigil.
That was the unfortunate product of a soldier's overzealousness. However, you are right. We have killed. For a cause.
Rush waited.
If the fate of the Earth is at stake, maybe that could be justified. But the films you've shown us, the history you've cited...
She stopped and pointed toward the craft.
It all seems contradicted by that. It's done nothing in our presence,
And the device we just excavated, it didn't zap anybody. How do we know those films weren't doctored? I'm not sure I buy your conclusion. It's out to destroy us. Maybe it was intended to be benevolent.
Benevolent,
Rush repeated, in a mixture of surprise and derision. With a gesture, he brought one of the guards over, then spoke to him briefly in a low voice. The man saluted, walked back toward the hangar entrance, then plucked a microphone off its wall cradle. After about 10 seconds, he put it back. Rush, meanwhile, strode back and forth, with the air of a man for whom both patience and time had run out. As Nora glanced from the colonel to Tappan and back, the hangar door opened and a soldier entered, holding a cage of some kind. She handed it to Rush, saluted, then turned and walked out. The guards remained in their positions by the hangar door, which stood open. Rush turned toward his prisoners.
Come with me!
Then he made a direct line toward the alien craft. Nora and Tappan followed. The colonel walked so quickly that, despite herself, Nora soon felt herself slowing behind him. Rush walked past the outermost yellow ring of the concentric circles, then paused immediately before the orange ring and looked over his shoulder. He snorted when he saw that both Nora and Tappan were hanging back.
What are you worried about?
He asked in an acid tone.
We've learned the hard way how close we can get.
He put the cage on the floor, opened it, withdrew something, and straightened up again. Nora saw he was holding a lab rat. It had hooded markings, with a black head and white body. Like most such animals, it seemed naturally tame, unfazed by the strange surroundings. It looked around, beady black eyes glancing this way and that, whiskers bobbing as its little pink nose sniffed the air, disgusting bristly tail wrapped around the colonel's wrist for balance.
Hurry, he said sternly to Nora and Tappan. Come up here.
When they reluctantly joined him, he indicated the circles painted on the floor.
Over years of painful trial and error, we've learned that, as long as we make no threatening moves, we're safe on this side of the orange line.
He paused.
Or would you care to go farther, Dr. Kelly? Maybe touch it? Why not? You, after all, were the one who used the term benevolent.
He looked at her, one eyebrow raised quizzically.
No? Very well. I want you to remember, it was your own suspicious nature that made this necessary.
With his free hand, he stroked the big rat for a moment.
In my experience, these poor fellows live rather short lives, 2 years, maybe 3. They always seem to develop tumors. I wonder sometimes if so many generations have been bred for experiments that cancer has become part of their genetic structure.
He continued stroking the rat for a moment, almost thoughtfully. He scratched behind its ears, thin almost as tissue paper, the tiny veins visible, like a young leaf's. Then he raised his arm and gently pitched the rat underhanded toward the craft. Nora, taken by surprise, watched the equally surprised rodent arc through the air, front and back feet outstretched, tail whipping in a circular motion. It began to sail down toward the alien craft, and then the rat's fur suddenly glowed, flickering with unnatural colors. As the brightness became blinding, the animal's skin grew transparent, and she could see the muscles and organs and skeletal structure. A sound like the shriek of violins cut the air. Instinctively, Nora turned away, shielding herself from the alien glare. And then, abruptly, both the light and the noise stopped, followed only by the faint sound of liquid hitting concrete. She turned back. Everything was as it had been before, except now there was a small splatter of indeterminate color on the floor just inside the dark red ring. Beside her, Tappan stared, thunderstruck. Rush took them both in, shaking his head almost sadly.
You pressed me for an explanation of how the craft can invert molecular structure, he said. That, of course, was before you mused about its benevolence. I've given you your example. The weapon scans an approaching form, determines its composition, then disassembles the atoms that compose its structure. In this case, it simply denatured the animal proteins of the lab rat, alas, now deceased. The creature essentially fell apart on the molecular level, as so many of our soldiers did decades ago, leaving behind a soup of carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, water, amino acids, and salts. Rush nodded at the guards, who stepped forward, submachine guns held across their chests in readiness. You've both been given a full explanation of the alien's malignancy and a demonstration. He stepped back outside the ring of concentric circles. I need your answer, and I need it now. Tappan had an expression on his face Nora hadn't seen before, like someone who'd just been punched in the gut. After a long moment, he took a shuddering breath. He glanced at Nora, then back at Rush.
All right,
he said, voice low, chastened.
You've convinced me. I'm on board.